This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oakland.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to our customary Wednesday night feature here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. It is Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Mike Penna alongside my usual entry mate here on the network. You know him. It's Jude Feld, the pontiff of the Pick Four. A bit of a Breeders' Cup edition of the show tonight as we are looking ahead to the Breeders' Cup World Championships coming up Friday and Saturday. Jude hosting this show live from the Great Race Place in Arcadia, California, your hometown, by the way.
Yeah, I was born and raised about 5 miles from here, pretty much. Trained at Santa Anita for 20 years. Very fortunate to be able to do that, and love coming back to Santa Anita. It's one of the most beautiful places to watch horses train in the morning, and of course, it's not the Great Race Place for nothing. Some fantastic racing here over the years.
And fantastic racing upcoming this weekend. You're going to hear every single Breeders' Cup race with us coast to coast and worldwide right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. You can visit horseracingradio.net for a complete listing of affiliates, that entire schedule, and SiriusXM channel information, all at horseracingradio.net. Speaking of SiriusXM, we do want to welcome everybody just joining us across the country on Sirius Channel 93. And for those of you who have been with us for the past 3 hours with our live racing coverage on XM 209, welcome back to the program. And of course, all those tuning in worldwide on our website. I mentioned the Breeders' Cup edition of the show. We're going to begin with trainer Jeremiah Engelhart, who is going to be represented in this year's Breeders' Cup. It's his first trip to Santa Anita, so we'll have some fun talking to him about that. And in the second half of the program, trainer Jim Cassidy will be with us. So some outstanding guests to get to tonight, JT.
Yeah, Jim Cassidy's a guy that I've known for a long, long time. He used to work for vets on the backside, and then he became a trainer. He's had a lot of success, so I've known him, but today was the first day I got to meet Jeremiah. He seems like a fun guy, and I'm looking forward to talking to him.
And he will help us kick off this edition of Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Jeremiah, the 36-year-old native of Hershey, Pennsylvania. You think of chocolate when you think of Hershey. Where the hell's the chocolate, man? You didn't bring us any chocolate.
No chocolate, but by looking at me, you could tell that I like it.
Well, welcome to the program. Happy to have you on and to hear your story. Is it true that this is your very first trip to Santa Anita?
Very first trip to Santa Anita. Second Breeders' Cup. I was in Churchill in 2011 with Tamron Hall, and second time here with Ria Antonia.
Well, it should be a lot of fun for you. I know it's going to be a great experience. When did you get into town?
I got in late Friday night. We breezed Saturday morning. The filly got here on the 22nd, so she's had time to acclimate and everything like that. So far, everything's going very well.
Well, obviously, the show all about you and your background and how you got started in the game. Your dad was a trainer, and is it true? I think I had read somewhere that you were actually walking hots for your dad at the age of 6.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, I was. I'd be in charge of making sure all the horses got fed and, walked the horses when they came back from the track. And they were never afraid to throw me into it, at a young age. And, before I remember even going to middle school, I'd go and feed the horses at the farm and take care of them before I even went to class in the morning. So
this was a family business for you. You were in it from the start.
Yeah. Yeah. I had no choice on what I was going to do. I tried. I went to college, got my business marketing degree, and I actually did an internship selling knives, and that lasted about a month, and then I went to training right after that.
Smart Cutco? Man.
Was it Cutco?
I was a Cutco guy. I've been there.
Yeah. I think I threw up at one of my, sales. I think it was my girlfriend's aunt and uncle that I didn't really know that well, and I was trying to sell him some knives, and I had to go use the bathroom. I knew it probably wasn't in my blood to do that after
did
that.
At least have some sympathy for you or empathy, I guess.
Oh, yeah, they butt something.
Yeah. Hey, whatever it takes.
Yeah. They need to even make me finish my presentation. They said, you know what? Let me just see the pamphlet and we'll buy something.
Didn't even get to the part where you had to cut the penny.
No penny, no rope, nothing.
That's fine.
Well, that's a great story. What do you remember about those very early days and being around your dad's operation?
You know, I remember asking my dad a lot of questions. I remember when I was really young, I had a favorite horse by the name of Tennessee. And every time I remember going over to the paddock my dad would saddle him, I'd always ask him, Dad, is he going to get claimed? Dad, is he going to get claimed? Every time. And his answer was always, no, it's an allowance race. He can't get claimed. So I remember when I was young, just asking him a lot of questions. And I took a really big interest in it when I was young. And just the overall being around the animal was a lot of fun for me.
Yeah, it's a great experience for kids. I know my kids enjoyed it when I was here. My son, Miles, he used to come home from the track full of poultice because he loved poulticing horses' legs. Yeah. And my grooms were all guys that worked for me for a long time, and they'd let him go in the stall, and he of course I was the same way. I'd get it in my beard and stuff too. But yeah, that's a great experience for kids, and they really love it. I mean, and I'm sure it was such fun for you to be able to go and work with your dad. That had to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. I mean, for us to share that kind of same interest and passion, it made it that much more special.
Did he always want you to be a trainer?
No, he never really pushed me towards one thing or the other. Kind of let me just figure it out. I mean, when I was younger, I wanted to be an NFL. I wanted to be in the NFL player. I was played in high school, college, and when I realized I wasn't going to make the pros, that he kind of let me figure things out by myself, which I kind of do with my kids too. Let them do whatever they want.
What position did you play?
I was linebacker in high school, and then oddly enough, to make the varsity team in college, I played tight end. So.
Where'd you play in college?
I went to, it was just a small D3 school at first, Cortland College. And
is that in New York too?
Yeah, in New York, yeah. And it was one of 3 of 100 freshmen to make the varsity squad as a tight end. Then the day before our first game, I was running through a pass Barrett and broke my foot. And didn't realize I still had to go to classes and dropped out of college after that.
Back to the racetrack we go.
Yeah.
So were you always, even when you were in college and playing football and committing yourself that direction, did you always kind of think, boy, it'd be nice to get back to the racetrack? Or was it at that point were you kind of out of it?
No, I always followed it. And at that time it was just mainly my dad and what he was doing. And I really didn't have the exposure like to the bigger tracks. It was more like just, I was just thinking about Finger Lakes, what my dad was going to have for horses the next year, or what he was doing during the year. It was actually that winter was my first winter in New York, where I went to work for my dad, and we did very well. So I actually stayed on. That was '94. I stayed on to help his string there in the spring, and then we kind of pulled out of there around May and went back to Finger Lakes, and then I actually went through a divorce and went back to New York in 2001. And worked for my dad, and then I stuck on and worked for, spent 9 months working with Mike Hushin, and kind of wanted to stay there and learn the whole, I was just amazed about the whole NYRA experience, in the big leagues to me.
Yeah. How much different was it working with Mike than with your dad?
It was a lot different. He's a very, very good manager, and not intense is the wrong word, but he's serious. And where my dad, being his son, I could have a kind of a different relationship with him than I could with Mike. But I remember I used to wake up every morning thinking how I was going to try to get Mike Hushin to laugh every day. That was that was my one goal.
How'd you do it? What was the best way to do it?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if I could say it on air, but whatever I could think of, really.
So it was, you took it upon yourself to bring some levity to a rather serious barn.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have those experiences around barns, like if you don't have a lot of horses and you're stabled with somebody that's like really uptight and serious, and then you're obviously a very gregarious guy and enjoy what you do and love the game, so you're in a good mood, and you see this guy every morning that's like miserable and tense, and you just go, how can he live like that? I mean, trainers are among the luckiest people in the world. They get to come out, be with the horses, come out, watch them train, drink coffee, shoot the breeze with your friends, talk sports or whatever. I mean, it's a great lifestyle
without a doubt.
And it's really funny how there's some some trainers that just really take it like so seriously that they never have a good time, and it's too bad.
Yeah, Mike was very serious, but I think it also helped him, you know, focus on, you know, what he was doing. I mean, not that I don't focus on what I'm doing, but I think here you're right. I mean, I have so many friends and family that, boy, I don't want to go to work today, or I wake up every day and I can't wait, you know, to go to work. I love watching the horses train. I mean, you can get the worst news of your life, you know, as far as your business goes, any morning, anytime. And you know what? There's all horses that need your attention. So, but you're right. I mean, you wake up every day with that desire to kind of, you just love doing what you do.
Talking with trainer Jeremiah Engelhart here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Jeremiah, you mentioned the difference in the relationship that you could have with your dad and obviously with Mike Hushin.
Yeah.
I played sports like you all the way up into college, and my dad was very demanding. He wanted me to be the best I could, you know, both as a person and as an athlete. Who was harder on you, Mike Hushin or your dad?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I don't ever remember my dad being too hard on me. Mike wasn't really hard on me. I was mainly, when I started, I was filling in for someone who was on maternity leave. So it was kind of like it was going to be a part-time thing, you know, at the time. And I'd say they probably both, you know, managed me equally and just in different ways. You know, Mike was demanding where, you know, hey, listen, you have a job to do and you work, you know, I'm not working for my family, so I didn't really get much leeway. You know, you had to be there on time. You had to, you know, he did give me some leeway on certain things. Like, you know, I changed feed once with him, and I to me, that was it was not a pat on the back, but it was something like, wow, he's going to allow me to try this or try, you know. So it kind of made the job that much more interesting.
Yeah,
you know,
and vote I did, of confidence.
Yeah, yeah, and I did have to give him some bad news one day. I'll never forget, I treated a horse with medication that was in that day, and he was 3 to 5 morning line, and I remember having to walk in, and I'm like, you know, my dad always saying, you know, if you're gonna do anything, just be honest. And I could have said, oh, I can't tell him that I just made this mistake, I don't want to lose my job. But I always think back to what my dad said. I said, listen, if you're gonna do anything, just be honest. I went in and told him. I thought he was not, you know, he wasn't happy that it happened, obviously, but he appreciated that he knew that someone had his back if that was working for him. So
yeah, it's nice when somebody that you work for on the track takes your advice and treats you almost like an equal instead of like the hired help.
That's a
big plus.
Yeah.
So when did you officially decide that, hey, this is something I want to do for a living, I want to go out on my own and try it?
Well, I worked for Kenny McPeak for a little over a year.
Oh, you didn't tell us that part.
Okay, yeah.
Here comes the good story.
Kenny, yeah, I was going to say Kenny was probably more demanding than any of those other two. I used to have to call Kenny from the barn phone at 5 o'clock every morning, but that was, you know, part of his regimen and what he wanted me to do. So I had to do that. And I'm not the greatest. I'm not the best morning person in the world, but a couple times I actually called him from my cell phone and I had to tell him that the barn phone wasn't working. I'm sorry, Mike. I forgot the question. I'm getting off on
it. So did I. So don't worry about it. Just keep going. Once we got into Kenny, it was all over. Okay.
I don't think there really was a question. You just wanted to find out the McPeak story.
Yeah. Hey, when did you determine that this is what I want to do for a living and I want to try it on my own? And how difficult, or was it a difficult decision to make?
You know, for me, when I was about 18, I had a horse when I was working with my dad. And I was going to RIT at the time. I actually did really well in college when I went back, and I kind of had to pay for it myself and figured I wanted to get a degree. I was at RIT, and my brother and I claimed our first horse. And it was just a $6,200 horse that we claimed, and we did really well with them. And I kind of knew at that time that's really what I was going to want. I wanted to do. But I wanted to work for some other people to try to get some other perspectives on how to do things. And you know, Kenny and I had a little bit of a falling out. I was really immature. I think I was 21 at the time. And I had one guy who was going to give me a horse, and that was good enough for me. I, you know, got my first stall at Belmont Park and started training from there.
Yeah, that's good. But you got a stall at Belmont Park because Bill Mott couldn't get any stalls up at Centennial Park in Colorado.
Yeah.
Trust me, horses weren't good enough. Think about that.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't that easy. I remember Mike Lakow gave me a hard time over, and actually I thought he broke my hand when I shook his hand and he gave me one stall. He gave me a stall in the receiving barn. And the first night I bought all new equipment. I didn't even have a tack room, so I had to like keep it outside the stall in a tarp. So I trained my filly the first day, and the second day I didn't have any tack because they stole it all. So the second day was a little tougher than the first.
So you're obviously a young guy. I mean, 36 years old. Yeah. You're in your second Breeders' Cup. What do you consider to be your first really big break as a trainer on your own?
I think when I won the Bed of Roses with Tamron Hall, I think that was a big confidence boost for me as far as really knowing my horse, knowing, like, finding out about the, you know, reading numbers and, you know, talking to people that are really good handicappers that can give you a good insight into races. I remember I'd won an allowance race at Finger Lakes Racetrack, and I got one of the guys I was talking to, she ran a two on the rag numbers, and she ran a net minus two on the thoroughgraphs, and I kind of, they're like, you know, she's a nice horse, and so I took a shot and nominated her to the Bed of Roses. I'm thinking, you know, Hilda's Passion's in there, I can't beat her. I mean, that's Todd Pletcher, that's, you know, the nicest sprinter in the filly in the country. If I run second, though, that's, you know, I paid $23,000 for this filly, and she was running a $19,000 claimer in her last start before I bought her. So when she won that race, I kind of really had an idea. I'm like, you know, this is, you know, if I really listen to people and, you know, listen to my horses, you know, when they're ready, I can figure this whole thing out a little bit. So that was a lot of fun when she won the Bed of Roses that day.
Yeah, you've obviously had some success buying horses for not much money and turning them into something good. The filly that you're running, the Breeders' Cup, a $9,000 Phasic Tipton purchase. This filly, $23,000. You talked about a $6,250 claimer.
Yeah.
So it's not like somebody's handing you the cream of the crop. You're developing these horses, you know, on your own, pretty much from scratch.
It's working at Finger Lakes is a big benefit for me, because you see, it's not the bottom of, it's not necessarily the bottom of the barrel, but you get so many different issues with horses, whether they're not broke properly and you're kind of, you know, working over, starting from scratch, or you get something that's got a bunch of problems and you have to try to figure out a way to train the horse, you know, without just trying to get the horse right. And that helps me, because here in New York, I mean, usually you get horses sent to you that are kind of ready to go, and when they start having the problems, you know, you can catch it at early stage, or you see so much growing up at Finger Lakes, kind of helps you out as you get older and get into the, you know, the better racing.
What would you say is your philosophy when it comes to training horses? What's the one thing that you say, okay, this is how I run my operation?
Oh boy, I like to think that my biggest thing is just I like to have the people that work with me know when their horses are right, you know, when their horses, because, you know, I have a split operation. I have horses at Finger Lakes and Belmont, and I wouldn't be able to do anything without the assistant that I have at Belmont, Elizabeth Dobles. I mean, if she wasn't there, you know, she's been working with me now for 3 years. She started as an exercise rider when she was 16, I think, with me. No, I'm sorry. I think she was either 17. So she knew how I wanted the horses to be trained. She knew when they were right. And I guess if there's one thing that I try to do more than anything is just try to figure out the horse when they're doing well and when they're not. I think that's, you know, all you can really do.
Your wife, Robin, yeah. Involved in the horse racing industry? Is that how you met her?
No, not at all. I met her at a bar. I'm coming home from
here. Here comes the good story.
Yeah,
the heck with my peak story.
Yeah, you guys got time? No, I, you know what? I was, I was divorced once before, and I was coming home from New York to actually spend time with my ex-wife, and it didn't work out. So I made a deal with a buddy of mine that I was, you know, that was home and I was hanging out with. I'm like, listen, I don't care what we do for the next month, but we're going to have so much fun. It doesn't matter. We went out every night for 3 weeks straight, and I was still working for my dad at the time. So it was kind of, you know, he gave me a little bit of leeway, because he knew when I was home, the reason why I was coming home. So I was actually out one night, and I dated a lot since my first wife, and never really found someone that I kind of liked. And I met Robin at the bar, and it was the first person that I was like, actually felt like, wow, I really want to hang out with her again. And kind of made me think about, I didn't think about anything else with my ex-wife. All I thought about was her. And we hit it off right off the bat. And her first trip to the horses was a horse I owned by the name of Goodman Sam. We drove down to Charlestown. I had him in one night in like a 15 claim or something. And he win. I said, oh, now we can get our washer and dryer. And ever since then, she was hooked. Because anytime one of her horses won, she could get something to do.
Well, what's she going to get if you win the Breeders' Cup?
Oh, I don't know. I was probably have to pay a lot of bills.
Visiting with Jeremiah Englehart on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And you have kids. You have, what, three,
yeah,
four
kids?
If I'm not mistaken, all under the age of three, is
three
that right?
Three and under, yeah.
How on earth are you doing that?
My wife. I don't do anything.
Wow.
Yeah, she's phenomenal. When it comes to the kids, I mean, without her right now, I probably wouldn't even be training, because she's, you know, I mean, like right now, she's this whole week, she's there with all four kids, and I get reminded of it a lot, but she's a trooper. She really is.
Boys or girls?
I have my oldest daughter, Raylan. She's three. Then we have twins, 18 months, CJ and Anna, so boy, girl. And then our newborn, Eli, who's 3 months, is he's a boy, obviously a boy, too. So two boys, two girls.
Will you have them walking hots when they're six?
They can do whatever they want. But if they're going to do it, they're going to have to, you know, at least, you know, attempt to do it right, you know. If they wanted to work, Raylan, she loves the horses, so I won't have a hard time. I know she'll want to be at the barn. I won't let her leave my side, but, you know, I know she's already into, like, she wants to start riding and stuff like that. So, Anna, the first time I showed her a horse, she cried for 3 days, so she might not be as much. CJ, the twin boy, he will do anything. He wanted to punch a horse the first time, so he's either going to be a boxer or mixed martial or something. But I think they all have something to do with horses, yeah.
Wow, interesting stuff. But what if they come to you one day and say, Dad, I want to be a horse trainer. What are you going to tell them?
I tell them that's fine. You know, just make sure you commit to it. You know, and if that's what you really want to do, then give it 100%.
So. Maybe some little football players in there too.
CJ, yeah, he's football, basketball. The first time I just bought him this little basketball hoop, and it's one of those, you know, play school things where he picked up the ball and just kept throwing it in the basket. I'm like, he didn't even know what he had to do, but he knew he had to put the ball in the basket. So maybe I can get lucky and he'll be some kind of prodigy or something.
Yeah, we need to call Calipari right now. He'll probably sign.
we'll see if we can get that done for you. So are you still into sports? We always like to ask trainers what else they like to do when they're not at the track. What else do you enjoy? Are you still into sports?
Oh, yeah.
And
I mean, I play, I'm into watching all the sports. I'm a Giant fan. Unfortunately, a Met fan in baseball, but now I've become more of a Boston Red Sox fan. And in basketball, I'm a Knicks fan. But I play basketball more than I do, obviously, the football now. But I'm into a lot of the sports.
You know, you're from New York, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The whole Boston Red Sox thing just doesn't fit. You know that.
But I wasn't a Yankee fan, so it was okay. The Mets have stunk for so long that I can. You know,
this is our next guest is a Yankee fan.
Yes, he is. Yes.
He's never without a Yankee hat.
I hope he's not behind me right now.
I met Jim Cassidy, of course, who we're talking about coming up next on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. And I met him for the very first time this morning in his barn. And I had told him, I said, well, it's great that you're a Yankee fan. So am I. My wife is a Red Sox fan. He says, and you married her?
Yeah.
What were you thinking? So, no, that's great. Well, looking ahead to the Breeders' Cup, obviously this year, you mentioned that doing extremely well, the Phillies doing great, everything on track. We want to wish you all the best for that. And really appreciate you being here with us. What does the future hold for Jeremiah Englehart in the stable?
I hope the sky's the limit. You know, I'd love to be in a position Bob Baffert's in, or Todd Pletcher, or any Bill Ma. I mean, those guys, you know, even if I'm doing what I'm doing right now, I'd be happy as long, you know, I love what I'm doing. So whatever, sky's the limit. So we'll see.
Well, it's great to have those aspirations. All those guys are in the Hall of Fame. So
yeah.
if you get a shot at something like that, I hope it works out for you.
I appreciate you.
We only have a minute or two left here, but just one more quick question. I was thinking as he was answering that question. Did you have an idol outside of your dad? Did you have an idol, a trainer that you looked up to growing up that you said, wow, I really, really like the way he does things?
I have to say probably Shug. When I was younger, I think it was mainly just because the horses that he was, you know, working with. But I kind of always admired the way he handled himself inside the business. And, you know, now that I start my own and I have a couple different strings, I think understanding what guys like Todd Pletcher and you know, those big outfits that have a lot of horses, I really admire what they do, because not being able to see a certain horse every day, you need to have the right people in line. And, you know, of course you need the right clients. And I'm really lucky that I have great clients that understand what I want to do with my program. But those two guys I kind of really, you know, looked up to. Bill Mott, he's phenomenal. I can name every one of them that are really good at what they do. So,
Jeremiah Engelhart, ladies and gentlemen. Jeremiah, thanks so much for being with us tonight. It's been great to hear your story. A lot of fun, and all the best in the Breeders' Cup and all the best moving forward there as well.
Mike, Jude, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
All right, and Jeremiah, like all of our guests who appear on the program, receives a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors, Flair Equine Nasal Strip. So we'll get that out to you, and look forward to catching up with you up the road.
Great. Thanks, guys.
All right, we're going to go ahead and get to a break. Trainer Jim Cassidy is coming up in the second half of the show. We'll hear his story coming up next on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
November 4th, after the Breeders' Cup, the Thoroughbred World turns to Lexington and Fasig Tipton, and arguably the world's most significant mixed sale. In just one day, Fasig Tipton will present a star-studded catalog at the November sale. Proven Grade 1 and Group 1 winners and producers, top-graded stakes winners, and quality selected weanlings. The November sale at Fasig Tipton. One day in November. Where will you be?
I'm here with Dr. Jim Chiappetta from Flair, makers of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, here in North America, horsemen are protecting their horses with Flair strips. Are the strips benefiting horses in other parts of the world?
Mike, horsemen around the world use the strips to protect lung health. For example, South African horse at the Euro Variety Club regularly races with a strip. In South Africa, many graded stakes, including grade one stakes, have been won in 2013 by horses wearing the strips. In New Zealand, reigning horse at the Euro Mufasa races with a strip, as well as many thoroughbred and standardbred stakes winners in Singapore and Australasia this season.
To learn more, visit flairstrips.com.
RacehorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RacehorseReport.com. Make RacehorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RacehorseReport.com.
The 2013 Daily Racing Form National Handicapping Championship Tour is off and running with tournaments virtually every week. Last year's NHC and Tour had total prize money of nearly $1.8 million. Jim Bennis, a horse player from Chicago, Illinois, landed the grand prize of $750,000, an Eclipse Award, and the title Handicapper of the Year. Find out more by visiting nhctour.com and join the tour today to begin your quest for the NHC in January 2014 in Las Vegas.
Imagine having 80 channels of live, full-card, uninterrupted simulcast feeds delivered direct to your home television for just $50 a month. Choose from your favorite thoroughbred, harness, quarter horse, and greyhound tracks in North America and internationally. Call Dish Network at 1-888-677-5487 and ask for RTN, the Racetrack Television Network. RTN is the only place where you can see every race from every simulcast, every day.
Want to know what we're up to?
Yeah.
Then log on to horseracingradio.net.
It appears that the website has become alive.
Horseracingradio.net is your official home for HRRN on the web. Read our blogs, download our podcasts, link up to our Twitter and Facebook pages, listen to live streaming of all of our broadcasts, and much more. HRRN is your home for racing's biggest events, and our home on the web is horseracingradio.net. That's horseracingradio.net.
This is Eddie Delahousie. You're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Well, Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Jude Feld, live from Santa Anita. And Jude, a fun visit in the first half of the program with trainer Jeremiah Engelhart, a young man who has done very, very well for himself, and want to wish him all the best.
Yeah, he's a terrific guy and really loves the game, been in it his whole life, family business. So it was fun to meet him, and now we get to turn our attention to Jim Cassidy, an old friend of mine. We've known one another for maybe 30 years.
Yeah, it's probably every bit of that. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, well, it should be a lot of fun here. Jim Cassidy joining us on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. And Jim, it was funny, Jeremiah told us that he started walking hots for his dad at the age of 6. You didn't get into horses until a little bit later in your life.
Yeah, actually, I got in the early 70s. I was rubbing horses for Joe Canny, and I worked for a vet. We worked for Whiteley when we had Ruffy and all those kind of things. I got in the show horse business when I first started, and back in a few years before that.
Yeah.
One thing led to another, and I had a little place on Long Island, and I started getting layups from the racetrack and taking them. When I got around the thoroughbreds, I just, you know, this one thing led to another.
What first attracted you to the thoroughbreds?
Well, when I first got them as layups, you know, just a different kind of horse. You know, we had mostly cold-blooded type horses for the hunters and jumpers. We didn't have the quality that the thoroughbred brought. And, you know, I mean, it's like night and day. You know?
Yeah.
So I was very appreciative. I had several opportunities early. Guys gave me a chance here and there. And then I came out to California because it just seemed like the thing to do. I came out here in probably the end of 80, 81. And been out here ever since.
And I had read that you grew up quite close to Yankee Stadium. What, 6 blocks from the stadium?
Yeah, the stadium is 161st and River Avenue. I lived on 167th Street. And, you were a Yankee fan, period.
Yeah. Yeah, that was it. You didn't have a choice.
Well, in those days, you had Dodger fans or Yankee fans, and people that didn't care, they were Giant fans. I mean, all three teams were so close together at that time.
How often would you go to the stadium?
I'd probably go maybe twice a month, you know, things like that. You couldn't go all the time. It was, you know, it was a little costly, especially in those days. 75 cents was a lot of money for.
Is that what it's 75 cents?
It was 75 cents to sit in the bleachers, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Who was your favorite Yankee?
Oh, Mantle, probably. Mantle and Ford. Those were the two. I got a lot of memorabilia by those guys, and he was probably the greatest player I ever saw.
Yeah. Yeah, greatest game you ever saw in Yankee Stadium was what?
Well, I didn't see it because I was in school when Larson pitched his no-hitter. I was halfway home, and they were screaming at me, get home, get home. And when I got out of school, because we went to Catholic school, and there was no taken off.
Oh, no.
And I had a nun called Sister Benedict, and she was a Dodger fan. So there was no...
It was funny because I went to Catholic school, too, and the nuns, if they were baseball fans, which a lot of them were...
Yes, they were.
If they were baseball fans, they'd let you watch the World Series, but he's 100% correct. If it was a team they didn't like, you would... That was it.
No
there
chance.
Was no chance.
They weren't cutting you
they
any
were
slack.
No.
Under no circumstances.
But probably the greatest game I ever saw was the... And that I didn't see it in person was Bucky Dent's home run in Fenway Park.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a good one. Aaron Boone wasn't bad either, by the way. But
well, Boone's was, yeah, but Boone's was kind of an afterthought.
Yeah.
Dent's was the best.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in Western Massachusetts, but grew up a Yankee fan. I was a huge Greg Nettles fan, and I'm sure you got a chance to see him, too.
You know, we have that argument. There's a couple of guys around here that are pretty stellar. Staunch baseball fans, and I've always said that Nels was as good as Brooks Robinson. Of course, they don't agree with me.
Yeah, they won't like that one.
The man was incredible. I can tell you a story. We left Monmouth Park that year in 77, and Monmouth Park closes before we used to go from Monmouth to Gulfstream. So it closed, and we wound up at Garden State to train the horses. It was not racing there anymore. And I was staying at the Holiday Inn with Chuck Taliaferro. And Chuck was a big Dodger fan. And him and I would watch the games. And at the Dodgers were up two games to none. And then the third game, they went ahead like 4-0 or 5-0. And I threw Chuck out of the room. And the Yankees went on to win the next four. So I know he was a great guy, Chuck. He was a good friend of mine. And but, you know, it was great back there. It's great back there.
Now, you wear your Yankee hat every day, and your saddle towels are Washington Redskins.
Well, that's a whole different story, dude. What happened back in the day, when I was a kid, we were all Giant fans, of course. And then they got a guy called Allie Sherman. And we used to go to the game, and they used to sing Goodbye, Allie. That's what the fans would sing. It was a pretty popular song. And then he kept trading all the good players away, and I don't know what was going on. And finally, they traded Sam Huff to the Redskins, and I went with him.
There you go.
And I've been there ever since. And the old Redskins were 1-9 that year. I'll never forget it. And I didn't care. I still don't care. I love the Redskins.
You know, talking, by the way, with trainer Jim Cassidy here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Jim, we've had a lot of trainers on this program over the last year or so that have told us that one person who really helped them get started in the game was trainer Joe Canty. And you were around his operation. That was your first job, if I'm not mistaken, on the racetrack. Talk about that experience, because everybody has just talked glowingly about Joe.
Well, Joe was a great guy. I mean, he was such a stickler for detail. I mean, right down to the shed row. I mean, everything was just had to be pinpoint perfect. And of course, when I was with him, I think we had 8 horses, and that was it. And he was a fabulous guy. He was married to Charlesy at the time, mm-hmm. And it was never any problem. I mean, as long as you fed his ego, he was all right. No, but Joe was a good guy, and you know, he actually got me going, and he gave me some nice horses to take care of. He had a filly he got from the West Coast, I'll never forget, and it was the one and only time I ever met who I considered one of the greatest riders ever, was Baeza, and he rode this filly. Her name was Dangerous Bluff, I'll never forget, on Thanksgiving Day, and he won a race on her, and I think he carried her about 3/8 of a mile. I think he actually got off and carried her and still won the race.
He was good. Yeah, he was outstanding.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, some great memories. And then he was real tight with Whiteley's and all those people. And I used to be around Frank quite a bit. Another character that'll be missed.
Yeah.
The Fox of Laurel.
Yeah. When you first came out to California, you worked for some veterinarians. And that had to be a fantastic experience, seeing that many horses every day.
It was. You know, I had several. You know, it was a totally different working in the East Coast than coming out here and working here. It was like, oh my God, it was totally different. I mean, it just, people out here did things differently. They took care of the horses differently. Everything was different, and it was kind of hard to get used to. I think I had 3 jobs in 3 months. Dude, I just couldn't. You know, there was just certain people I just couldn't work for them. They just, there was no foundation. You know, it was just bing, 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 bing.
Right.
You know. So then I got offered a couple of jobs, and I took those with the veterinarians. And I mean, it was a wealth of knowledge that I got for 9 or 10 years, I guess.
Well, it's obviously worked, because you've been here for a long time. I guess it was about 81 is what you said, is when you finally moved here to California. Was it difficult at first when you came here, Jim? Was there an acceptance factor that had to be developed, or how was it when you first got here?
When I first drove into this place, I thought it was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm serious. People laugh, because I drove here, and I the first city I saw was Blythe, California, and I thought it was like heaven. And people say, Blythe? And I said, look, you don't know where I came from, man. And And when I came out here, it was different, of course, and you had to adjust a little bit. But it was no, I mean, people didn't, they were friendly.
Yep.
I think the East Coast is a little more an acceptance problem than it is on the West Coast. Everybody gets friendlier here. But, you know, until it's like going to Churchill, everybody's really nice to you until you get in the starting gate.
Right, yeah.
You know, that's just the way it is. But, no, I didn't have a trouble with adjusting at all. I cleaned up my New York accent, and I was on go. Because everybody said all those New Yorkers, they're just a bunch of buttheads.
I Bobby Frankel trailblazed for you.
Yeah. Yeah, Bobby, he was another great guy.
Another great guy. Well, you were around here every day in your shorts, pretty much same uniform, shorts, Yankee cap, going barn to barn with the vets. And I think you had a tremendous amount of credibility when you decided to go out training, because people knew right off the bat that you knew what to do with horses, that there was no question like there is with some people, even like there was with me. I mean, that, you know, whether I knew anything about training horses or not, I think with you, when you started to train on your own, you had a tremendous credibility factor because of the people that you'd worked for right here at Santa Anita and Hollywood.
Well, I appreciate that, dude. I had two young boys at the time, so. And you always worry about family and supporting them. And so I really couldn't take off. And then, in fact, the last guy I worked for, I was with for about 9 years, I guess. And he said, listen, you've come as far as you can go. You need to go out on your own. And that's pretty much what pushed me in that direction. So, it's hard sometimes. You get the clutter in your head from clients, and they want to do this and they want to do that. Well, everything looks great on paper, but you know, in the real world, you know, things happen. So that's a difficult part of it, you know, trying to appease everybody and yet trying to make sure the horses are okay. I had difficulty with that at first because, you know, like me, I would like to take my time. And of course, I remember the first horse this guy bought for me. He says to me, you like the, I said, I really do. I like this horse. I bought it from Elmendorf. It was go back a little bit. It was a three-horse package. And Skippy said to me, he said, Jim, you got to buy all three. I said, I can't afford all three. I can only buy one. And I love this one. He said, you do? I said, yeah, why? Said, well, okay. Well, I got to sell this package. Hollendorfer is coming by tomorrow. He's going to buy them. So next day, he says to me, you still want that horse? I say, yeah, I thought you sold it to Pat. He says, no, Hollendorfer hated that horse. So he only bought the two. I said, well, I love that horse. I know. That's what I'm asking you. I said, well, I'll buy him. So I give him $7,500. It was all the money I had. And then I got a guy. He says, all right, I want to get it. So I run the horse. I had to get him together in a hurry. And I run the horse. And I put Gary on him, Stevens. He finishes fourth. And Gary, you know how Gary is after a race. And the owner's down there, what do you think, Gary? Well, this horse is a piece of rust, and he's lugging in, he's lugging out, he's doing this, he's doing that. So the guy says to me, he said, look, if this horse isn't going to work out, I don't want to keep paying on him, so get rid of him, send him up north. I said, no, give me another 2 weeks. So in 2 weeks' time, I run the horse back. I put Gary on him again, and the horse wins. So he gets off him, and he says, well, Gary, he wasn't a piece of garbage. Yes, he is. I'll never forget it. It was classic. Anyway, the horse wound up doing pretty good. He went on with starter allowances on the grass and stuff like that. I just loved the horse. His name was Royal Torrent. It was quite a long time ago, but he was quite a nice little horse.
Jim Cassidy joining us on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Jim, so many trainers have told us, you know, you devote your whole life to this game, and you work so hard to try to achieve a high level. You had to wait a long time for your first Grade 1 victory. It came in 2004 with Ticker Tape. It had to be a very special moment for you.
Yeah, it was. Of course it was.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we bought her. It was, you know, we buy horses in Europe all the time. So I got these three clients over in Europe. And they said they were finished. They don't want to buy any more. I said, well, what about this filly that sells on Thursday? And no, we're finished buying them. And I can't even tell you, Jude, Mike, how many times I bought horses over in Europe. with no money. But, you know, either do or you don't. Somebody has to hustle. And I luckily was able to sell everybody, sell the horses. But anyway, so there's still sales. And one of the guys stayed with me, Darren Pearson. He stayed with me. He said to me, Jim, if you want this filly, we'll go buy her. I said, all right. So we bought her. And, of course, that was ticker tape. And she was just, I mean, the real deal. And it's just funny how everything works out. I remember Kent rode her all the time. And then I told his agent, I think it was Brad Pagan at the time. Yeah, it was Brad Pagan. I said, Brad, I'm going to run in the American Oaks. And he said, oh, okay, I'll get back to you. Now, you know what that means. So DeSormo, who had ridden her in the honeymoon prep race for this, finished fourth on her, but he had her back too far. And, you know, just, you know how things fall into place. You know, they just get. So anyway, he can't get a mount for the American Oaks. So they come back to me, they say, you still running in there? I said, well, you know, Kent doesn't think she'll get a mile and a quarter. I said, well, it depends on how he rides her, you know. So anyway, he rides her, and I said to him, look, remember what we did in the honeymoon? Let's just do the opposite here. Get her in the race, just lay third or fourth, and finish with her, quicken with her. Because nobody could quicken like she could quicken. And that's exactly what happened. And luckily for us, the Japanese horse who was the favorite got stuck on the fence, and Yaki Taki couldn't get the thing out until it's too late. And we never get caught. So it was great. It was really, really something special.
And of course you had some moments prior to that were special as well. I'm sure that first trip to the Kentucky Derby, you've been there a couple of times now. I'm sure that they were each special in their own right.
Yeah, no, the Derby was great. I mean, the first time, I mean, we took a homebred calbred to the Derby, one of the fifth or sixth, whatever it was. And,
yeah, but that was Jamaican Rum, by
Jamaican
the way, in 2001.
Yeah.
And then your second trip was with Ocean Sound.
Well, Ocean Sound I didn't want to run. And because he ran so good in the bluegrass, everybody got excited and wanted to run him. And I was dead set against it, but I was overruled. So, and Ocean Sound was a nice horse. He just, between the Rebel and the bluegrass, he was kind of knocked out after that. So, but the Derby with Jamaican Rum, that was quite exciting. I had some clients at the time that owned him. They were very, the mother was a very difficult person to deal with. I mean, she was honest, but she was very difficult. So before the race, she congratulated me. And I'm thinking, we haven't run yet. She goes, no, for being here. And that was when I realized how important this thing was. She says, do you know how many horses were born last year and this only 20 have made it to this? And I'm thinking to myself, wow, I never realized how important it really was to some of these people. With that Derby fever, you know.
It had to be important for you, too, just to be there and be part of it.
I was numb. I was numb to the whole process.
You still remember making the walk?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I remember it all. And that's the great thing about where we get gratification is the fact that we can relive these things more so than an owner can, because we've been in the trenches with these horses and we know exactly how it came about. But, I mean, it was a fantastic experience. And I wouldn't do it again unless I had the right horse. If it was insisting upon me to go, I wouldn't do it just to do it.
Yeah.
When you've talked about buying the horses from Europe and you've had so many successful ones, I mean, what is the knack of finding those horses? You do it better than probably anybody I know. Well, and you don't spend a lot of money for them either.
No, I know. But you've been lucky too. But I just look for athletes, athletic looking. Most of the horses over there, the mares that they, the fillies that they sell, they're all turning, they're going to turn three when I get them. They're two-year-olds turning three, and they got a little bit of form. But most of them are, the pedigree's okay. It's not stellar, of course, they keep them. But they try to get rid of these horses, the middle-of-the-road horses, because they're into buying yearlings all the time, so they need room in their yards, so they keep their very good horses, and and they buy yearlings with the money that they get for these. But we look for athletes, like I say, if you can get a little pedigree. It's hard. People say, well, you always did so good with fillies. Well, to buy a colt over there with any size and substance, you're fighting jump steeplechase people. And they got so much money, you got no shot. And or a colt that's run less than six times, then you're fighting Hong Kong. So it's a process.
Do you find it harder now with the Dubai Carnival to acquire those European horses?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then the other problems are they claim they're all drug-free over there. Well, they can claim that until the cows come. That's not the case. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on over there. Obviously, you read and you can see between the lines, there's a lot of stuff going on over there. And I'm not saying everybody. I'm just saying that it does happen, and you have to be very, very careful. But I do enjoy those horses. They're very professional horses, and I, like you say, we've had some success, and actually we're trying to buy a few this week. So,
you know, one of my favorite horses that you had trained, she was so cool, was Evening Jewel. Really loved her, and she provided you with a lot of memorable moments.
She was probably, pound for pound, one of the best horses we ever had. Because she laid it every time. I mean, it was absolutely amazing. And, of course, if you watch the Kentucky Oaks, that was enough to break your heart, you know.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, that post that they have there, you guys are familiar with that thing. Well, that ain't the wire. I thought that was the wire.
Our broadcast booth is right there at that
the
post.
The wire is about how many? Yeah, it's enough to get a nose across.
Right. Yeah, and then it was blind luck.
Yeah.
Right? And blind luck. Blind and that luck. Was a great rivalry. And we talk about Sunday Silence and Easy Goer. Maybe it wasn't quite that, but Evening Jewel and Blind Luck had some battles. And Blind Luck always seemed to be a bit of a thorn in the side, wasn't she?
It's funny how that come about. I'm sitting up here. We're at the races, and Janine Sahadi was a friend of mine. And Janine said, did you see that thing Hollendorfer ran yesterday or whatever? I said, no, I didn't see the race. She goes, wow, some filly named Blind Luck. This thing was just a monster. And she's going on about it. And she's usually correct about those things. I didn't think anything of it. So now I come to run against her here, and she beats me a nose in the grade two. And I didn't think anything of that. You know, that was pretty good. I ran great and all this stuff. Now I'm getting serious. So we go back to Kentucky, we win the Ashland. Everybody's saying, well, you'll be back for the Oaks. Oh, yeah. I had no intentions of coming back here, back to Churchill. This filly had her head between her legs after the Ashland. I mean, she was totally knocked out. I couldn't believe it. So I took her home. We were out here in California about 3 or 4 days later. She starts getting all excited and carrying on, and I'm thinking to myself, man, oh, man, it's a typical woman. One day she's like this, and the next day she's like this. So we went to back, and she ran the great race, probably the best race she ever run in the Oaks. But Blind Luck got us again, the same nose.
Hollendorfer got back at you for buying that $6,500 starter horse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you ever think that you won that race at any point?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
Because I was with my rider. My exercise rider, and I said to her, we won it. You know, we thought we won it because we were right there, and everybody was around there was saying we won it. But, and of course, Hollendorfer, he was up. We were down on the track level, so that was a bad vantage point,
very hard. Yeah, it's very hard to watch races at Churchill Downs. I always say it's the worst place in the world to watch a horse race. I mean, unless you're really high up on the roof, it's very difficult to see with all the tents and all that they put up Derby week. It's almost impossible to get a good line on a horse.
Yeah, what Ben Huffman told me, it was probably the most exciting Oaks they ever had. I said, thanks a lot.
Yeah, happy to be part of it.
Yeah. We're glad you were a part of it, yeah. It must be the same feeling John Sullivan had when he saw that that statue of John Henry in the Bart at Arlington Park.
Well, you know, the old story is on there. Delahousie told Sullivan he had him short. Was too short. and so it would come back with, it took me a week, I had to get two blacksmiths to get the bit out of his mouth.
So, what, Jim, what would be your personal career highlight? What would that be if you had to pick one moment that you would say, this is my moment?
Oh, you know, I don't know. I mean, you got to understand, there's been a lot of situations. The man that owned the eating, I mean, he had cancer. And he had been fighting cancer for over 7 years. And it was real bad. And that filly actually kept him alive for a year. I mean, the doctors all said, he said, that's unbelievable. This man should be gone. And all he ever said to me was, all I want to do is win the San Clemente. So I said, okay, well, we'll try and do that. Well, and she wins she won the honeymoon, the San Clemente, and once she won the Del Mar Oaks, this man, he was like 6'4", 6'5", big, tall, thin man, very thin. And he was a staunch businessman. He was in the insurance business, but he was tough. And he used to give me a lot of stuff, a lot of crap, you know, about different things. And I saw that man crying when he won the Del Mar Oaks. It about broke my heart. Like, this man was not that way, if you understand. And he was dead 2 weeks later. It was
wow.
So, I mean, you got that. When I ran Diamond Diva in the cash call mile, and she beat Ventura by a nose, I would tell you, that was priceless. I mean, if you saw that, it was priceless. And, of course, Ticker Tape winning the American Oaks. And when the kill row here with Milk and Mick, that was priceless. I mean, so it's just so, you know, I've been so lucky, you know, to actually have these horses. And there's still some new things to happen, I hope. Everybody said, you're going to retire? I said, yeah, when I keel over.
Permanently retired.
Yeah, that's what Charlie Whittingham used to say. Why would I retire? I go to the races every day and eat steak every night. What would I do if I retired?
It's funny because Jeremiah Engelhart in the first half of the show tonight told us that he never feels like he has to go to work. He wakes up in the morning and he says, I never complain that I'm going to work.
Right.
I never think like that. I'm sure it's the same thing.
Well, it is, unless you've had too much Glenn Levitt the night before. you know, that...
4:30 doesn't look so shiny.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And you wake up, regardless of go to bed at 11 or 12, you still wake up at 3:30 or 4.
Yeah.
You might not want to get up, but you wake up.
Yeah.
So
what is it that Jim Cassidy likes to do outside of racing? Obviously the Yankees. I'm sure you still watch all the Yankees.
Yeah, I watch all the Yankee games. I'm into a lot of music, a lot of different kind of music, and the races, you know, that's pretty much it.
Yeah. What's your favorite music, favorite artist?
Well, I mean, right now I'm into a lot of old music. You know, go back to the Artie Shaw's and the big bands and all that sort of thing. I'm into that right now. I used to be into classical a lot. I have a lot of classical music, but I'm not too into the rap and stuff, obviously. But I'm a big Sinatra fan for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny, when Jim and I met for the very first time this morning, I said, do you go by Jim or James? What do you prefer? Because he's James in the program. And he said, no, it's Jim. I just keep James in there just for my mom.
Yeah, I can still hear her. When she went to James Michael, I knew I was in trouble.
That's it. When mom uses your middle name, it's never
good. It's never a good thing, is it?
So, Jim, this has been so much fun. We could have spent another half an hour easy, yeah. But thank you for taking the time to be with us.
My pleasure. It was
Talks.
A lot of fun.
Yeah,
it's
been great to hear your story, and all the best in the Breeders' Cup and beyond.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Trainer Jim Cassidy here on Trainer Talk, presented by Basic Tipton. Wow, two outstanding guests here tonight. Of course, if you missed any portion of the show, it will be available for you on our website, horseracingradio.net, later on tonight. We're back tomorrow, Thursday, with our Breeders' Cup Countdown replays from 3 to 6 Eastern Time on XM 209, and then from 6 to 7, this program will be the BristNet.com call-in show live from Santa Anita. We're talking Breeders' Cup. Make sure you join us tomorrow night. So a lot of things to look forward to, Pontiff.
Yeah, it's a great week here at the Great Race Place.
All right, our thanks to Jeremiah Engelhart and to Jim Cassidy for being with us on the program here tonight. Don't forget our Breeders' Cup coverage going all the way through the Breeders' Cup Classic on Saturday night. You can visit our site, horseracingradio.net, for a broadcast schedule and to listen worldwide. It's all at horseracingradio.net. For Jude Feld, Pontiff of the Pick Four, I'm Mike Penna. We will be back with you tomorrow on Trainer Talk. See ya.
Good night, Barbados.